Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of The Working Experience, a very warm, open-arm audio embrace and a squeeze. This episode is brought to you by my company, One Circle Media. One Circle Media is a hybrid digital agency and media content creator. We create and design apps, websites, videos, social media content, and physical products. We are artists, directors, designers, producers, coders, editors, thinkers, makers, and creators who embrace story and creativity from design, web and app development, animation, docs, features, TV shows, digital and social media content to physical products. For our clients, we create content that builds networks and audiences across multiple platforms. Check out our work at onecircledigital.com and onecirclebrand.com. If you work for a network, studio, brand, startup, or corporation and are looking for a partner to create media that will build, engage, and entertain, reach out to me at john@onecirclemedia.com. I'd love to hear from you. This episode is also brought to you by an app that I created called Still Believe. Still Believe transforms a picture in your home into video proof of your child's favorite magical characters. With the app, parents can catch the magic of the Tooth Fairy, leaving money under their children's pillow, or Santa delivering presents on Christmas Eve in their home. You download the app, take a picture, and we create the magic. We utilize feature film visual effects artists to transform your picture into video. Just tell your kids that you have a special app that can detect and capture the Tooth Fairy, then present them with the video proof in the morning. The look on their faces is priceless. Your Still Believe video is created in minutes, and you can then save it to your phone and share it on social media. The app is available for the iPhone and Android, and it's free to download. Our aim is to bring joy and wonder into the hearts of children around the world. Check it out at stillbelieve.co. Thanks, everyone, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Working Experience.
The Working Experience.
Route 93 North is almost at a standstill. It's a rough one out there this morning. Snow and sleet.
There is no service on
the... Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Yeah, folks. We're going to be a few minutes. We have train traffic ahead of us. We should be moving shortly.
John, we need that report ASAP.
Where are we on that presentation?
Man, HR wants to see you.
Did you return that email yet?
We have a team meeting at 10.
To stay late, Bob.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
We're moving in a different direction.
And after the meeting, we'll have a breakout session.
Who ate my
Where are my hot pockets?
This microwave is disgusting.
Oh, God, what's that
He was clipping his toenails at his desk. I can't take it anymore.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of the Working Experience Podcast. It is my pleasure to have Ms. Brittany Wagner with me today. Ms. Wagner was featured in the Netflix series Last Chance U. She was the academic advisor to the student athletes at East Mississippi Community College. Since then, she has been an adjunct professor at the University of Montevallo, teaching event and sports management. She is a nationally recognized motivational speaker and consultant, and welcome, Brittany.
Thank you, thanks for having me.
Did I manage to get everything there?
Most of it, all the
Most
important
stuff. Okay, all right, good. Well, if there's anything to add, we will add it. So just to start off with, can you tell us about yourself, where you're from, your education, family, anything like that?
Yeah, well, I'm originally from Clinton, Mississippi. I guess the better known celebrity out of Clinton, Mississippi is NSYNC's Lance Bass.
All right, nice.
Yeah. So that's I'm not the most famous person to come out of Clinton by any stretch, but
NSYNC meaning the boy band from the 90s?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, all right. Yeah,
I went to high school, grew up with Lance, so I went to high school with Lance, so.
Wow, okay.
Great guy.
Nice.
So yeah, I grew up in Clinton. I lived in Clinton, Mississippi my whole life. Pretty much lived in Mississippi my whole life. Went to college, went to Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama. It's a private school for a year and just really had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. But I knew that when more people went to the library than to a sporting event, that I probably was not at the right place.
Right.
So I decided I probably should not stay at Samford much longer. So I transferred back to Mississippi State University, where I majored in sport communication undergrad and then got my master's in sport administration, both from Mississippi State. And then, then after that, I was introduced into athletic academics as a graduate assistant. I had worked in the athletic department as a student worker my whole time in college, and then wanted to get my master's degree, but couldn't pay for it. And so I went to the athletic director and said, do you have any graduate assistantships that will pay for my school for me to get my master's? And he said, we have one left and it's in the athletic academic office. And I had no idea what that was or what I would be doing, but I just was like, yes, I'll take it because I wanted my school paid for. And it was really within the first 2 weeks of being in that office, I shadowed and worked directly with the football counselor at Mississippi State, and that she was a strong, independent, or still is a strong, independent African-American woman by the name of Ann Carr. And just watching her and her interaction with those football players, the difference that she was making in their lives, I immediately knew, like, okay, this is what I'm on this earth to do. And so from then on, that was the track.
Were you a sports fan, like in high school, middle school, all that?
I was. I wasn't really an athlete. I played tennis my whole life. Started playing tennis at a really young age and played competitively at a really young age, probably too young. I think I got burned out and was offered a college scholarship to play tennis on the collegiate level and I just didn't want to play it anymore. But that was it. I wasn't, I didn't play a bunch of sports. I wasn't really that talented athletically. I don't have any brothers. I do. My mom and dad were avid sports fans. And so I feel like whenever there were big games on, we were always watching them in the house, and they taught me a lot about the game and athletics. But I don't know. I often think about that. Like, how did I even get into sports and interested? Because it wasn't really a part of our family, or, I didn't have a brother that I traveled around with watching him play. I don't know. I think it was kind of in my blood at a very young age. And by the time I went to college, I was an avid sports fan. And I knew that I wanted to do something in the sports world for a career. I just didn't know. I didn't know what it was. And, I just kind of fell into the athletic academic role but knew instantly that it's what I wanted to do.
Well, it's funny because I've never been a football fan. I'm not really into it, but when I watched Last Chance U, it was like the human drama of it. Well, I don't like to use the word drama because it wasn't, what was so interesting was the lack of, how do I say this? It was one of those reality shows that was real. That was authentic. Right. That's the word I'm looking for. And I was like, wow, this is really these kids really need help, and you guys really provide them a lot of help and guidance, and that's just very compelling.
Yeah, I think that the interesting thing about especially season one, I don't think any of us knew what we were getting ourselves into. I didn't have Netflix at the time. I was a single mom. Netflix was not in the budget. Right. So I didn't know, I didn't really know what Netflix was about. I don't think a lot of our players had Netflix. This was 6 years ago, really before Netflix was kind of what it is today. But I think that was the reason why one of the reasons why season one was so authentic and real was because I don't think any of us really thought anybody was going to watch it. I think that we kind of thought, like, who are these people? What are they doing? And who's, I remember really thinking, like, well, maybe I can get my family to watch it, but no one else is going to care. And yeah. I think that I didn't feel like I had anything to lose because I just didn't feel like anybody was going to watch it. So I think that especially in season one, we were really ourselves and it was very authentic and real. In season two, I think there was a little bit of shift because the season one came out in July, the end of July, and we started filming season two in August. So we had about a month there where season one had come out and we were realizing, it took it about 4 months to really hit big time, but we were realizing, oh, a lot of people love this. Like, yeah. A lot of people are watching this. So I think there is a little bit of a different vibe with season two, because I do think we were all dealing with the success of the show while trying to film a second season. And I was trying to continue to do my job on top of all of that. And so I think there was a different level of stress for season two, for sure.
So did they just kind of come to you in the beginning and say, hey, we want to film this, and you signed a, whatever it's called, a release form and all that jazz?
Yeah, interesting. So GQ magazine did a feature article about us. We had Chad Kelly, who is the nephew of Jim Kelly. That was our quarterback. And I don't know, he had been famously kicked out of Clemson during a spring game that was broadcast on ESPN for cussing out Dabo Swinney. And it was on TV live. Mm-hmm. And so he kind of had this reputation, and he was Jim Kelly's nephew, and there were a lot of people kind of watching him. And we had him as our quarterback. GQ magazine came in, did a feature article about our program, and that was how Netflix got kind of wind of what we were doing. And so when that article came out, Netflix saw it and said, look, this could be a show. And then they bought the rights to it and then kind of pitched it. Originally, I turned it down. When the producers called me, I just thought reality TV, Mississippi, poverty. I just thought that they'll exploit all of us and, yes, you know, and make fun of us. And
right.
I just didn't want to, I didn't want any part of it. And so I turned it down, and then the producers of the show came to Mississippi and really sat down with me and kind of explained some things. And we got, you know, I got to ask a lot of questions and kind of really fill out what their intent was. And once I kind of trusted the producers and the people that we were going to be working with, then I agreed to do it. But we agreed, it was a really quick turnaround. So we agreed March or April, and by July, there were cameras in my office 24/7. So, you know, I only had a couple months to really wrap my head around
what
I was about to be doing. And like I said before, I don't even know that I was really wrapping my head around what I was about to be doing, because I didn't think anybody was going to watch the show.
Yeah, no, I really felt like, yeah, I teach high school English, and but I also worked in the film industry for about 5 years. I worked on some reality TV shows. So, you know, it's kind of like, and then this guy I work with played junior college football. He still coaches. And he said, no, you got to watch this. And I said, well, I'm not a football fan. I don't care. And he's like, you got to watch it. It's great. And it's great. Just really, yeah. I don't think anybody really got to see like what people like you do, like behind the scenes.
You know, it is crazy. And I had worked in college athletics for 15 years as an academic counselor before the show came out. And I always, when people would say like, what do you do for a living? And I would say, well, I'm an athletic academic counselor. And then you would get this look like, what is that? And we really were the behind the scenes people that nobody really even knew existed. And in a lot of ways, we were the people keeping these athletes on the field. I mean, without academic eligibility and without someone kind of guiding them life skills wise off the field, a lot of these players would not have made it. And so in a lot of ways, these academic counselors are the backbone of these programs, but they're the people that no one knows about. And it's been really fun. I think that's been one of the most fun and rewarding parts of the show, is there's been a huge boom in young people going into this field and wanting to become academic counselors. And there's like this rush of, especially women now, wanting to do this and going into this field and trying to get experience as academic counselors. We've seen a lot of other junior colleges follow suit and create this position and hire people. A lot of high schools have started hiring counselors to manage the academics of their athletes. And so it's been really fun to watch Last Chance U kind of give a name and a face to this profession, and then see all these young people want to go into it and want to be somebody that impacts and changes people's lives.
You know, it was really interesting to see how much, I mean, you had that famous line, do you have a pencil? And it's like, it amazed me and gave me pause to see how much help. I mean, these are not children, they're adults, 18, 19, 20 years old. I mean, adults legally, Again, I teach high school, so I, you know, I use that advisedly. But how much help they needed just for every little get them out of bed. Do you have a notebook? Do you have folder? I remember you going and getting folders for.
Well, I think to, you know, to put all of that in context, I mean, do you have a pencil now has definitely, yes, become a hashtag and kind of, it has a lot of symbolism and different meaning behind it. But really in the beginning, when I was walking the halls and handing out pencils, it was literally about, do you have a writing utensil? Like, are you going to walk in class and actually even pretend to take notes? Like, I think the thing that, you know, a lot of people, especially in this country, don't realize is we have a lot of young people that don't have access to basic resources. Mm-hmm. And these kids were 40 miles away from the nearest Walmart. They had no car. They had no money. They came to college with a backpack, two pairs of clothes, and a toothbrush. And that was it. And so I learned really quickly, I mean, within a couple of days of being at East Mississippi, I can either beat them up and have this pretentious attitude of, how did you come to college without a pencil? What's wrong with you?
Right.
Or I can just hand them a pencil.
Yeah.
And be done with it and set them up for success. And I can continually, and if they lose the pencil, they can understand that they can walk back in and get another one. Like, that it's not that big of a deal. I mean, I can impact their lives that easily by just handing them a pencil and not making it this big ordeal and shaming about why you don't have a pencil. And and that's really where it started, was just understanding that these kids didn't have, I went to college with a U-Haul. I mean, literally, like, I had matching bedspreads and I had every resource I needed to be successful. And the truth is I still performed mediocre. And I had every resource available to post, you know, graduate parents. My dad has a doctorate. My mom has a master's. And I still just kind of, you know, didn't really put forth effort and was mediocre. And so when I think about that, and then I think about kids who are coming into college and they nobody in their family has a college degree. They don't know anyone that has a college degree. They have literally nothing. And they're being shipped clear across the country on a Greyhound bus to a completely new environment. And then they're just told, like, well, make it work. I mean, I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. And so that's kind of where the pencil thing started, was just making sure that, like, okay, we at least walk into a class looking like we're prepared.
Yeah, you know, I had the same experience teaching in the South Bronx. I was because I'm from a, you know, upper middle class suburb outside Boston, and same deal. My father was a lawyer, my mother's a speech therapist. Went, you know, I did okay in college, should have done a lot better. But then teaching there, you know, I said, get a copy of the New York Times and bring it in. Well, they don't have the New York Times in the South Bronx. And, you know, I had to learn stuff like that and be like, oh, okay, well, let me, you know, not readjust expectations, but be like, look, I can't come in from a certain perspective here. I got to unlearn a little bit. So.
Yeah. And I think, each child, each kid, each athlete is different. Mm-hmm. And their circumstances are different. Their experiences are different and their fears are different. And so this model that we can fit everybody in a box and, you know, treat everybody the same and have the same rules and the same expectations and the same learning styles or teaching methods for all children, I think is really outdated and not useful anymore. And so I worked hard and I didn't always succeed. I wasn't always great at it, but I worked really hard at letting each athlete walk in my door as they were and then going from there, whatever that looked like, you know, moving them from there and knowing that every single one of them was going to be different, was going to walk in with something different.
Well, they really seem to respond to that.
Well, you know, who wouldn't? I mean, I think that's, you know, like, that's the key is, like, when you want to impact people and you want to make a difference in people's lives, then you have to see them. Like, you have to see them for who they are. And and be okay with that, like accept them, and then say like, look, I, you know, yeah, let's start here and work from here, work from there, rather than, no, you need to meet my expectation because I'm the superior or I'm the authority. You know, I just don't, I, that's not effective. And yeah, I think when they knew that I cared about them genuinely, and I didn't care about them from the perspective of like, how many touchdowns are you going to score? How many tackles are you going to, but I cared about them as people, like, tell me your story. How are you doing? Are you okay? You know, I think I asked different questions and responded to them in a different way than a lot of them were used to.
But you also didn't seem to pull a punch when you had to land one.
I don't ever pull a punch.
Yeah, like, look, this has to get done, you know, like.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you're not doing anyone favors when you're enabling, you know, bad behavior. And so, and I think I had a lot of athletes that would come to East Mississippi from high schools where they were the guy, you know, they were the five-star athlete that was going to get that entire community out of poverty or get that entire community out of the situation that they were in. And so they had been allowed since junior high to do whatever they wanted to do, you know, and they would tell me, like, I never went to class in high school. I sat in coach's office all day long. I got to school at 10, you know, I walked in, I did whatever I wanted to do. I never went to class. I did. And that was kind of their mentality coming to college, was like, I'm the star athlete. I can do whatever I want to do.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's why there's a part in season one, I think it's season one, where I say, you know, I stand up in front of you guys and I tell you how it's going to be. And every single one of you thinks I'm not talking to you. Like, you think like, well, she's talking to all these other people that aren't five stars, but she's not talking to me.
Right.
And I would have to break them. I mean, to let them know that, like, I'm absolutely talking about you. And it was a challenge sometimes, because when you're allowed to do something for 4 or 5 years, I mean, it's habit. And I would have to break those habits and behaviors in order to get them to the point where they could be successful at the next level.
Well, and I think when kids have that kind of, I don't know, sometimes it's chaotic and sometimes it's just not, there's no boundaries, whatever, that they want that and they respond. Like, they interpreted that as, someone cares enough to yell at me. Someone cares enough to get, you know, mad when they need to, as opposed to like, go do whatever you want.
Absolutely. I think structured discipline, you know, I mean, I think everybody wants it, you know, to some extent. I was just in Florida working with some athletes that I work with in Belgrade, Florida. And I had one or two athletes in there, and I said, pull up your social media. I'm going to check your social media. Because I was trying to teach them that nowadays, you know, your social media is who you are to coaches that are recruiting you. I mean, they don't know, they're going through your social media and they're looking at, what do you like? What are you posting? What time are you posting it? I mean, and this is a reflection nowadays of like who you are, your character. And so I started looking at, and I would say like, okay, you need to delete this, change this. You know, I was kind of helping. And next thing I know, I looked out the door and I had a line of athletes with their phone in their hand, waiting in line to let me check their social media, because they do want it. Like, they do want, they don't know. I mean, and when you don't know what you don't know, you can't do anything about it. And so, and they wanted me to check it. And they wanted me to tell them like, no, delete that. You can't do this. So I think you're right. It's interesting that people buck the discipline and but they really want it.
Well, so like a recruiter might look at their social media and say, you're up posting at 3 a.m. picture, like, what, you know, like, this is not they would interpret that as like, this is not a disciplined person. You should be in bed.
Correct. I had coaches that would say like, we're going to pull the offer.
Wow.
On this athlete because he's consistently posting at 2 a.m. and at a Power 5 Division 1 program, you got to sleep. You know, wow. Like you need to be asleep at 2 a.m. So yeah, I mean, you know, and I don't think these young kids understand how much social media affects the rest of their life. I mean, yeah. We've seen it a little bit now where NFL players are getting held accountable for things they posted when they were 15. Yeah. And I don't know that that's necessarily fair, but it is kind of our reality. And so I try to help them and say, you know, look, here's some things that are not deemed acceptable. And maybe that's right, maybe that's wrong, but I'm just, perception is reality. And, you know, to a coach, like, this is just not okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And they, I mean, they're serious about pursuing this as a career. So I assume they take what you're going to tell them seriously, just in the, forget fair, unfair, whatever you think, this is what it is.
I mean, life's not fair.
No, it is not.
And it's not sunshine and rainbows. And so, look, here's what you got to do, like it or not. I explained to them, I really try to humanize the coach. And with this group I was just in Florida with, I had them sitting around the table and I said, look, you know, you got to understand that these coaches are making millions of dollars and they have a wife and a house and kids. And that check is supporting that wife and those kids and that house. And that check is dependent upon you doing what you are supposed to do. And you can only have so many bad apples before that check is going to be taken away from you. Right. And when that check is taken away from you, that house is gone, that wife may be gone. You're putting your kids' lives, you're messing up your kids' lives. You have to, and I'm like, they're not going to take that risk over and over and over again. They may take it on a Michael Jordan type freak athlete, but they're not going to take it repeatedly on kids that aren't Michael Jordan type talents. And really those are once in a lifetime type talent. So none of you are it.
Right.
So, you know, you got to see it from the coach's perspective that this is their livelihood and they are not going to get fired for you.
Right.
So either you're going to do what you're supposed to do and prove to them that you're going to do what you're supposed to do, or you won't get recruited.
And character matters.
Absolutely. It matters. And there's a sliding scale. The better, it's not fair, but the better you are, more talented you are, the less character you can get away with. But the worse you are, you better have some character and you better have some grades.
Yeah.
Because you're not that good. Talent.
Yeah. And fair enough.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny when you were mentioning about the humanizing the coaches, because I did a podcast with Coach Beam from there was a scene where this kid got hurt and he was crying, he was really upset, and Coach Beam went over and kissed him on the forehead.
I remember that.
And it was such a touching moment. I talked to him about it and he said, you can't be afraid to, because I mean he pulled no punches, he's a very tough guy and all that, but he said, this is a grown man, but he was hurting, and you got to show that side of yourself sometimes and let him know it's okay to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think too, especially in season two, the athletes knew my struggles too. I mean, they knew that I was a struggling single mom. They knew that I was 8 years of dealing with a coach like Coach Stevens, and that, you know, I was beat down and tired and struggling. And I think that the fact that I allowed them to see myself as a human being and I think really helped the relationship with the kids. There was real authenticity there in them seeing that, like, that I struggled too, and that, you know, I didn't want to be in scuba some days any more than they did, but we were here and let's go.
Absolutely.
I cried more tears in those 8 years of being than I probably ever have in my life.
It's such a, like, it seems like there's just so many factors that are beyond someone in your position's control. Like, you're dealing with these kids, you're dealing with the coach, you're dealing with their academics. They also need to play. If they're not playing well, they're not going to go to class. And it's like, I've taught 9th grade, 10th, 11th, 12th. I taught middle school. I taught, trying to motivate and be like, look, you got, it can get like, and now this kid didn't turn his paper in. Like, after I've been talking about it for a month and it's worth a test grade and I've told you this, that was due. Yes, it was due. This was a week ago I was doing this. And it gets like, what is going, why am I doing this? Like, why? If you don't want to turn your paper in, don't turn it in. But I can't, I don't know, I just can't do that.
Yeah. And, you know, the other part was I was the liaison really between all of athletics and our faculty. And you know, there's a lot of pressure in parents. And now I tried to not deal with parents very much, but but faculty, you know, there is that frustration of faculty who, you know, they're tired. They don't get paid enough. They're coming to me. You know, I've given this kid 5 different deadlines and and I'm trying to be the buffer between all people to keep everybody from, you know, blowing a gasket here. And there were a lot of days where I don't know, you could see it some on the show, but I almost always had a stress ball in my hand and I was almost always under my desk, just like squeezing the heck out of that stress ball. I had essential oils going in my office all day long, you know, trying to get me happy. And it was always me doing something to try to just help my mindset stay in a place of positivity.
And also there were the issues I remember with a couple of players who there were questions about them being injured. And, you know, obviously you were concerned about that. The coaches are concerned in a somewhat different way about that. And that would weigh, I imagine, very heavily. Like, here's this young person's health at stake and their academics and playing football and trying to juggle all that.
Right. And, you know, when you're 18 and you're trying to get yourself out of a situation and better your life. You know, when you're Ronald Ollie and you don't have anything to go back to, if this doesn't work, there's no plan B. Like you've got nothing.
Right.
Then you don't want to admit that you're injured. You don't want to admit that you might have a concussion because that's playing time. Mm-hmm. And playing time, and if you're not on the field, you're not getting recruited. And you don't understand at that age, when your whole life is dependent upon you being out there and playing this game, you don't understand the long-term ramifications. I mean, you're not thinking about what this is going to do to you, that you're going to have CTE and not be able to function as a normal adult when you're 40. You don't care. 40 seems so long, you know, long away.
Yeah.
That you're just trying to do whatever you can do in that moment to get recruited and get out of here. And so, you know, that was hard because I saw both sides. I mean, I would have an opinion for 5 minutes and then have another one 5 minutes later, because it is tough. And for something like a concussion, I mean, there's concussion protocol, but really, you know, they don't lay you down on the table and do a brain scan on you immediately, like you can do with an MRI or another injury. And it is kind of subjective to what the player is saying. So it was always kind of a struggle, and I always bounced back and forth between both sides of that issue,
right?
Because I just knew how important playing time and getting a scholarship, you know, for some of those guys, that scholarship was the difference in life or death. I mean, it was the difference in freedom or jail. And, that I didn't take that lightly.
Yeah. You hear their stories and it's amazing that they're there and they're as cooperative as they are, and that they made it there, that they made it that far, when you hear about all the stuff they've been through as kids.
Absolutely. If I had gone through half of what
I've
gone through, I wouldn't have been anywhere near where they were.
No.
No.
So what prompted the jump from where you were to your consulting now? And I don't know if I would use the word life coach, if you use that word, or motivational speaker.
We were filming season 2 and I was getting pulled in all kinds of different directions. I mean, I was getting requests to do speaking engagements. I was getting all kinds of requests to work with athletes in other places. I was having parents and coaches from all over the country call me and say, like, can we just pay you on the side, you know, to work with this kid? And I just started thinking that there was a platform out there because of the show that was something that I could have never dreamed up or created on my own, really. I mean, you don't create that platform without Netflix's help. And And honestly, I kind of felt like a fraud a little bit because I felt like I had preached so much in season one about me wanting to be where I could make the most difference in the most amount of lives. And then ironically enough, I was faced with that dilemma. Like, do I stay here and continue to work with the athletes that are brought to East Mississippi and continue to film this show for however long Netflix wants to film it? Or do I put, you know, do I follow what I said? And do I go and chase a platform where I can affect the most amount of lives possible in whatever amount of time I have before no one remembers who I am anymore? And I just was really torn. I think the whole time I was filming season two, there was this inner struggle of, what am I doing? Like, do I stay or do I go? Do I really maximize this opportunity to really impact people all over the world? Or do I just continue to sit here in my box, in my comfort zone? And it was really the athletes that pushed me to go. I mean, there's that scene in season two where Jay Johnson says, you know, Miss Brittany, you've been telling us, you tell us all the time to go for it.
Yeah.
We have to go for our dreams. And now you've got a dream and you have to go for it. We'll be fine. And I really, it was really them that pushed me, that really pushed me to do it and to believe that I could.
Yeah.
And so I did. I just decided this is what we're going to do. And I went out on my own and started the company. I had no idea what I was doing. I still most days have no idea what I'm doing. And my company, I think, is 4 years old now, and it's going great. And I have been able to travel all over the United States, and the amount of people that I've stood in front of or hugged, or high-fived, it's been an amazing opportunity. Could not have dreamed it up.
So who's like a typical client in the last 4 years for your company who typically calls on you to come and talk or do a seminar?
Yeah, I have a lot of schools. So a lot of high schools, junior colleges, universities. I've done a lot of those. Some for the athletes, but a lot for the teachers, counselors, staff development type meetings, where I'm speaking more to the adults than the kids. I also have organizations. I work with an alternative school in Pennsylvania that I love, and it's not athletes. It's just at-risk youth in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania that I work with. I have this group in South Florida that it's not a school. It's kind of an after-school program that these high school athletes go to keep them off the streets. Mm-hmm. I've been working with them. We've implemented some programming, some life skills programming, where we're teaching these kids money management skills, interviewing skills, etiquette classes, just, you know, really teaching them how to function in society. So that's the consulting is really that piece. I've also broken into the corporate world with the speaking engagements. I've spoken to Coca-Cola Corporation. I've spoken to I've done a lot of juvenile justices conferences and defense attorney conferences and parole officers, a lot of those national conventions, where I just really talk about the value of relationships and the value of giving someone another chance. Growing people from where they are, you know, offering kind of a do-over rather than a punishment, rather than throwing people aside or pushing people aside, really trying to help them to be better is the message with a lot of the adults. And it's interesting how the message translates. I've done a ton of banker conferences, which I always laugh at because I think I don't like, why bankers? But right. I mean, it's that whole mentoring and relationship piece of, you know, having some passion about what you're doing and having some value and having relationships with your coworkers, your clients, and that's where you build success is in those relationships. I call it doing things that computers can't do. Mm-hmm. And the only difference between us and a computer is heart. Is emotion. And pretty much nowadays a computer can do everything else. So the only thing that's setting us apart is that piece of of stepping back and not looking at data and not looking at statistics and looking at human beings and taking individuals and saying, okay, what can I do for this individual to better them, which will in turn better me? And I think, you know, human beings are built for connection. So I don't know that we're reaching our maximum potential if we're not making a difference in other people's lives. And I think in some of those professions where you are sitting in front of a computer all day and it is data driven and statistic driven, we lose some of that human interest aspect of what we're doing. And we start to lose our own mojo. You know, we start to lose our own passion and we're just kind of going through the motions of life. And I think when you snap back into reality, when you start connecting through relationships with people, no matter what your profession is.
What would you say if someone is not successful or struggling, like what's a common obstacle that you think people struggle with in terms of like, I mean, in my experience, it's not really education. It's not really intelligence. There are some very educated, intelligent people who fall apart. And there are many people who are very successful who are not that. So, you know, not more intelligent than anyone else. But if someone isn't, like, what's the common issue, would you say? Or is there one?
I mean, I do think that there are some. I think that, honestly, it stems, I believe, from a belief in yourself. And taking all of the exterior, this belief that like someone else did something to you, someone else is prohibiting you from being your best. You know, we hold on to all the stuff that we think people did to us. Or this belief that you're just not good enough. You're not smart enough because the ACT score doesn't say it, or the job title and the amount of money that you're making doesn't add up to say that you're good enough. You know, we have all these limiting beliefs about ourselves. And I think that that's what holds most of us back. We start to live in fear of all the things that we don't think we can handle on our own, that we're not good enough to do on our own. And we start limiting what we go after or what we do or how we behave. And we start kind of acting out or, you know, or just being idle and doing nothing because we don't have that belief in ourselves that we're good enough to do it on our own, you know, without anybody else's validation or support, that we have everything we need inside of us to be successful. And it doesn't, none of that is dependent upon anybody else. And I think when that kind of clicks with people, I think that's really the difference in what you're talking about. And that we get stuck on data and statistics, and we allow labels to tell us what we can and cannot do. When I talk to high school students, I always say, I don't want you to ever check another box. You know, and what I mean by that is we check so many boxes in life. I'm a female, therefore I can't do X, Y, Z. I'm an African-American, so I can't do this. I'm overweight, so I can't do that. Quit checking the boxes of what, because that's limiting you. No box is gonna, any box that you check, most labels that we give ourselves, they're not labels that help you to rise to something. They're labels that lower you to something, that eliminate things that you can do or be. And so, I quit checking the boxes and decide what you want to do and what you want to be, and then just start taking the steps to actually do it. Not thinking about what could go wrong or do the next thing, the very next thing, and not, don't look, you know, at, well, what if this, what if that, just do the next thing every day and see what happens. And will it always work out? No, but that's okay. Like it doesn't, that again, doesn't give you a label. It means you're a human being.
Right.
And you know, I think we've created this persona that human beings, you know, we don't fail, and we do. I mean, and it's okay. It doesn't make us any less than anybody else that we've had struggles or failures in our life.
Yeah. I mean, I frequently try to tell classes, you could fill a phone book with what I don't know and my failures, and you could probably fill 5 phone books with them, and that's all right. I'm still here, you know. And the what caught my attention is the what if thing. What if, so many times I've been in a meeting and it's like, well, what if this? Well, what if that? It's like, I'll see your what if and I'll raise you another imaginary scenario. And I think, oh my God, what? I don't know. What if kids like, well, what if we don't finish the test? I'm like, well, then you're going to fail the whole year and you're going to end up out in the street. I'm like, nothing is going to have, so you don't finish. So we'll take some more time tomorrow. Like, I don't know. Like, I just, that what ifing to death, like, what if a meteor hits?
We are a worst case society.
Worst like, case we could happen.
Worst case scenario society all day long.
Yeah. It's always like, prepare for the worst, hope for the best. I'm like, I'm not going to prepare for the worst. Why would I do that? That wouldn't do anything. I would not, right. I wouldn't do anything. Well, the other thing with perceptions is, you know, with checking boxes, it can also seem to work the other way. I mean, I'm a white male. I was born in America. I'm over 6'2". You know, those boxes can lead to like entitlement.
Absolutely.
And I always try to say, like, I'm not any of these things through my own talent. I didn't do anything to be born a man or to be over 6 feet tall. Mm-hmm. Many CEOs, an absurd number of CEOs, not only are men, but are over 6'2". And I always say, I'm here to tell you from personal experience, it does not make you any smarter to be taller at all. In fact, it may make you dumber, but for some reason, we still have this weird perception. And then it works the way you were talking about negatively.
Yeah.
Like I'm missing that.
I think I can remember my dad telling me at a very young age, Brittany, don't get confused with someone who was born on second base and someone who hit a triple. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that stuck with me my whole life, you know, and I was born on second base and I was always very aware of, I did not hit the triple. Like I, you know, my grandparents may have hit the triple, right. You know, but I did nothing to earn the basic spot where I landed.
No,
you know, in life. And I think sometimes we get confused. Like we see success and we think that someone that they, it was earned when really it wasn't. And then we've got a certain class of people that are just standing outside the fence begging to get on the field, you know, right. and want to hit the triple and could hit the triple, but we're not going to hand them the bat because we're standing on second base like we earned the spot. And right. I think, you know, that's very unfortunate and hopefully is on the mend of, you know, being changed in this country.
Have you seen, I was listening to it, well, I showed my class a TED Talk by this guy, Simon Sinek.
I've read his book, excellent book.
Yeah, he gives really good TED Talks. And he talks about like companies where people cooperate, they help each other out versus, I mean, that is not the management style of many other companies. It's very cutthroat, very competitive. What have you walked into a company, a situation you've thought like, wow, this environment is not conducive?
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time. And I think you're starting to hear the buzzword these days of culture change. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of the buzzword of the times right now. But I think it's a much needed culture change in a lot of situations. And you know, there's still a lot of athletic teams. I've walked in a lot of locker rooms and thought, oh wow, you know, like this is icky. You know, I think there was a time, especially in athletics, where that military mentality worked, that time is over. I don't think it's effective anymore with today's youth to have that dictatorship military mentality. So I think there's a lot of older coaches that are figuring that out, that style is no longer effective.
Do you get
and coaches that run their program that way? If you look at the coaches right now that are successful, if you look at Nick Saban and Dabo Sweeney, and they're not running programs like that. They're not running programs where they're not caring about the whole athlete and they're dictating and everything is a punishment and it's, you know, that's not what the programs that they're running. And I think that that's part of the reason why they're successful.
Well, and then, but then they would have kids do, I forget what they called them. They would make them roll across the fields if they showed up late. And I guess sometimes you got to say that too. Like, look, if you're late enough for a job, you're going to get fired and that's it. So,
Yeah, there's definitely got to be accountability. So there's got to be punishment. And one thing I've learned in college athletics is you can't run these kids because they, running is not a punishment for them.
Right. Right.
You have to come up with some ulterior options here.
Do you find you ever get like pushback where people are like, look, sounds nice, but that's not going to work here?
Not really. I mean, I think most people that hire me to come in, they're in a situation where they know what they're doing is not working. And they're hiring me because they are looking for something different and looking for a change. I mean, and everything I bring to the table isn't implemented, and we, you know, we have to pivot and shift and adapt along the way. But I think most people that hire me, they're looking to do something differently.
So is there, like, somebody's running company X and they're looking at like a manager or whoever's in charge and says, we got a problem here. Like, we're just not, this is not going well. And so they are then thinking, all right, we need an outside voice.
Yeah. And a lot of it is morale. It's motivation and morale. I worked with a school. I still work with them. I'm contracted with them where I posed as a student. I had a fake name and took online classes as a student to see what that process was like. And then I taught two classes online to see what that was looked like. And then I physically went to the locations and sat in with advisors and counselors and listened to phone calls and kind of to see what that process was like. And then I took all of that knowledge of 6 months worth of work. I took that to the leadership team and said, okay, I'm dissecting what I saw for 6 months. You know, here are some of your issues and here's the solutions that I think, you know, we have in front of us. And a lot of it is morale. A lot of it is, you know, employees being beat down and burned out and not feeling like they're important and kind of needing a boost. And some of it with the students are unnecessary policies, like unnecessary things that are creating fear or doubt in a student right off the bat. Mm-hmm. You know, having like a introduction discussion board for a class that, and it's got the criteria, the set questions of what they have to answer. And it has to be 275 words. Mm-hmm. That's very intimidating. You know, when the first question is, tell us about your family, and it's a homeless kid that doesn't have a family, they're stopping there. They're not doing the very first discussion board. They're going to zero because they're not going to be vulnerable enough to sit at a computer and go, okay, let me tell all 30 of you that I'm homeless and don't have a family. Yeah. And so, you know, it was looking at things like that and saying, you know, you got to create small successes early for these students, and you got to open the door and let them feel like this is something that they can do. And when right off the bat, you know, your procedures or policies are difficult, they're bailing before they ever start because it's a scary thing for people that don't know how to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, this has been really enlightening. You probably already spoke to this, but I just always wrap up with what do you enjoy most about your work?
The impact I have the ability to make on other people. When you get to meet someone and watch the light bulb go off, you know, and watch them grow and watch them change their life over a course of time, there's nothing like it. Whether it's the adults that I'm working with or the students, there's just nothing like impacting people to be the best version of themselves.
And if someone were to do what you do, be an academic advisor to athletes, things like that, if you were going to hire for that position, what attribute, what characteristic are you, like, what do they need to bring to the table to do that sort of work?
Patience. Mm-hmm. Patience, understanding. I think you have to have a non-judgmental attitude. I think you have to have a massive amount of awareness for yourself, but also for everyone in the room. Mm-hmm. I think you have to have the ability to offer yourself self-care, because it's a thankless job. And in any thankless job, you can burn out quick if you're not filling yourself up and taking care of yourself. And I think that's important to have that awareness of yourself, of what do I have to do to fill my tank up so that I can fill other people's tanks up. But as far as working, I think patience, I mean, you know, you can ruin a relationship with a student athlete in seconds with a snappy comment. And I think just having that awareness and patience to hear people out is key.
All right. Well, Miss Brittany Wagner, thank you so much for doing the podcast. It was great. And everybody, I'm sure, will really get a lot out of it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of The Working Experience. We'd like to thank our sponsors, One Circle Media and the Still Believe app, the only app that delivers video proof of the Tooth Fairy and Santa by simply taking a picture. Download the app at stillbelieve.co today and amaze your kids. And if you work for a studio, network, startup, or corporation and are looking for a partner to create media that will build, engage, and entertain your audience, reach out to me at john@onecirclemedia.com. I would love to hear from you. And that's it. The end. The sweet end. Until our next audio encounter.